to get out of what we got all here for, I hope. Dave told me just before the meeting there's 500 chairs set up in here, and I don't see but a very few empty ones. Looking good Friday night. I walked up to Bob this afternoon. I didn't know him. They tell me I heard him speak some time ago, but I still can't remember. That's my memory for you. I asked him if there's anything he wanted me to say about him this afternoon. He said, if you'll just say I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that'll be all right with me. I walked around a little bit. I told him all right. And I asked a couple of people that I knew that knew the man if they knew anything I should or they would like to hear said. And they told me about the same thing. Except one of them said, you know, there's one thing I know about him, he'll help a drunk. And I don't know any better thing you can say about an alcoholic. And that's all I'm going to try to say. It's not my job to tell this story. Help me welcome Bob B. from St. Paul, Minnesota.
My name is Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. Through the grace of God and the help of this fellowship, I have not found necessary to take a drink, nor have I since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity and the privilege to be here this weekend, and I notice the committee is spread all over the state of North Carolina, and it's really nice to see a convention that belongs to more than a few people and has a tradition that your conference has, and I have enjoyed myself so far. This was the first out-of-state conference that I had the privilege to attend. I was, in 1974, I had been friends of a gentleman who lived in Florida by the name of Wesley that many of you know, and I happened to be going down to Florida for a business purpose, and I called Wesley and I said, I'm going to come on down and like to see you, and he said, I'm not going to be in Florida. He said, I'm going to be in Durham, in the Raleigh-Durham area, North Carolina. He said, why don't you, you know, come on down. So in 1974, I flew into here on my way to Florida, and I had the privilege of attending your conference when it was in Durham, and that was really a wonderful occasion for me. I had had the involvement in conferences around my own area, but hadn't had the opportunity or privilege, and I was welcomed very warmly. I had the opportunity to read how it works at one of the meetings, and that was really a big deal, and this is a big deal too, so it's good to be back, and it's a pleasure to be here with many people that I've had the privilege of serving with in the fellowship and getting to know over the last couple of years. My job is to tell a little bit about what it was like for me and how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's like today. I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 14 years old. And through that experience and after looking back on it after I came to you, I've come to find out that that was a pretty significant event for me. And to relate how significant an event that was, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about the kid I poured the first drink of alcohol into. And that kid was 4'11", weighed 95 pounds, was the second smallest kid in his class. And as far back as I can remember, I never liked who or what I was. I always wanted to be something different. I wanted to be bigger or better looking. I wanted to be an athlete. I kept trying out for football, but I had a back problem. I had a yellow streak down the back of it. And for some reason, that didn't work out real well. I think no matter where you are, there always seems to be an in-group of people, a group of people who seem to live life more easily just by accident. They don't seem to have the difficulty in the making the adjustments that I seem to have. I think if I would have been able to have enough honesty or insight as someone asked me the question what I wanted more than anything else, I think I would have said to belong. Okay? Because not feeling very good about myself, I guess I set my sights on hiding in a group of people who I thought were okay. And so I started to develop the faculties that I thought would allow me to hide in that group of people. If they wanted a class clown that would do something that no one else would do, I'd do it. If they, you know, whatever it took, that was my goal. And I thought that they really did know something about life that I didn't know, and if I got to be part of that group and pretended like I knew what it was, one night we'd be out and they'd kind of talk about it and I could overhear and find out why, you know, why it was easier for them than it was for me. And I guess I was successful enough at being what they wanted me to be that I got to be part of that group of people. Except even after I got there, I didn't feel like I was part of it because I felt I was there because I was paying my dues. And if I ever stopped paying my dues and being what they wanted me to be, they wouldn't want me anymore. One night we were at a party and a friend of mine had a fifth and we went out and we split that fifth and I made a discovery. And the discovery was that when I put alcohol inside of Bob Bazan's, I got a feeling of comfort and well-being, the likes of which I had never experienced up until the time I took a drink of alcohol. I heard a friend of mine by the name of Tom describe it once. He said it was as if when God put them together, he left a few nuts and bolts loose. When he took his first drink of alcohol, it was like someone snuck up behind him with a great big screwdriver and just kind of tightened it all up. From that time on, I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned it. I was able to move within that group with an ease and a facility that was just marvelous. I was no longer aware of the pieces of me that made me feel insufficient. I felt smarter, perceived myself to be funnier and brighter, and it was as if I had discovered the secret that made life easier for everybody else. From that time on, I became a social drinker. Every time anybody else said, I'll have a drink, I said, so shall I. I just never passed up an opportunity to do it after that. When you do a lot of drinking and you're underage, you get into a lot of trouble, and by the time I finished high school, I'd done both those things, and my drinking problem, in quotes, was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home. And I come from a really neat home. I'm one of seven children. I have a lovely mother and father. No particular reason why I should have turned out to be a drunk, other than genes, I suppose, or whatever, and drinking alcohol. But I thought my drinking problem was my family's attitude about my drinking. With what level of honesty I had, I didn't think I drank differently than any of my friends. I look back on it now and I can see that what I did is I drank similarly to my friends, except that I just picked different friends and did it more often. You know, in high school I was doing it a couple of nights a week and most of the fellows were doing it one night every 2 weeks. And in college I was doing it every night and most of the fellows were doing it on the weekend. But I didn't perceive it that way. I had to perceive that if I got caught either by the police or my father, it never made any difference if you had one drink or 10 drinks. That was never the issue. The issue always was just flat, were you drinking? So I never wanted to run the risk of getting caught with one drink, because that never made sense to me. And so I thought that at least if I got caught, I'd have a good time, And I thought that if I had the opportunity to get away from the reasonably strict environment I thought I was in, that my drinking would become normalized. And I guess if that had been true, I wouldn't be standing here tonight. But I had an opportunity to go away to school, and a large part of how I made that decision had to do, I think, already at that time with drinking. But this time I had grown a foot and gained almost 100 pounds, but I never dropped the capacity. It was kind of like an insurance policy to be what I thought you wanted me to be. I was still the class clown. I was still the guy who had to be where the action was. I was the guy who was making false driver's licenses, and it was almost like I had a responsibility to go on out and have a hell of a weekend so when we all got together on Monday, they could talk about what I did over the weekend. I just never dropped that responsibility. To make a long story short, I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. One day, I just walked out. And it was a fairly steep progression of my alcoholism. I started out as an A student and ended up as barely a C student when I walked out. I was in civil engineering, and I just couldn't keep it up. I was going to school about one day out of every 10 by the time I walked out, or maybe every 15 days. And I didn't like it. It was just a bad deal for me. I was out there holding up my load, wondering where everybody went during the week, couldn't figure out, and they'd all come back and join me on the weekends, and we'd have a good time, and I'd go back out and carry my obligation and keep the action going until they came back. But by the time I hit my junior year, I remember for semester break, I locked myself in my room and ordered 6 quarts of alcohol, and I sat in my room for 5 days and drank 6 quarts of alcohol. My roommates were on a class trip to New York. And already by that time, I had known that it didn't make sense for me to spend $150 going someplace to do there what I could stay in my room and do. I had that figured out. I think a rather ordinary story, I have some rather spectacular ones that I won't share, but I think a very ordinary story probably tells the story of my drinking as well as anything. And it was during my freshman year. When I went to school at Notre Dame, it was a very strict school. They had guards check you in. You had to be in at 10:30 in the dorm. I think you got it about 11:15 as a freshman on Saturday night. But if you got caught drinking, you were just flat done. There was just no discussion about it. It was, you were just through. I remember when we used to drink all the way down on the train, and I was in Chicago in the lobby of the Drake Hotel, and I walked by a liquor store, and I saw the biggest bottle of alcohol I'd ever seen in my life. It was a gallon bottle of Seagram's Fifth Crown. And we never had gallon bottles in Minnesota. We just had quarts and fifths and pints and half pints. And I mean, I just had to have it. And I cashed in half my train ticket, and I bought this bottle and put it in my duffel bag, went back to my room. And one night I was at my desk, and I was drinking out of a flask, and I must have gone out for a potty stop and come back in the room and not locked the door, because all of a sudden the guard's in my room. And I'm caught, and I absolutely panicked. I can feel the feeling today. And this story never occurred to me until I'd been sober for 5 or 6 years. And I got between the guard and the door. And I said to the guy, I said, you can't leave. You can't walk out of here and do to me what you're going to do. I mean, it just isn't worth it for, you know, a couple of drinks. I begged him not to turn me in. I started to cry. I went over to the sink. I poured the flask out in the sink, and he did not turn me in. An hour after he left the room, I went back to my locker, opened my locker up, took out the gallon, refilled the flask, and continued to drink. And I didn't do that because I was just the smart aleck, you know, that I'd really put it over on him. When I was talking to him, everything that was important to me was right up there in the line, and I couldn't have been more sincere, and the crisis couldn't have been more real to me, but I had already reached the point in my young drinking career where I was no longer able to predict my behavior once I took a drink of alcohol. And once I started that process, I didn't always know where that process was going to stop, and as a result of that, I had to leave school. And when I had to leave, I was due to be commissioned that June as an officer in the ROTC program, and I had to get a medical release or it would have been immediately drafted. And they wired my doctor. My doctor sent down a diagnosis of chronic alcoholism, age 21. And that's what got me out of the Notre Dame, or on my transcript, and got me out of the service. I showed up back at home to a set of very disappointed parents, and I finished school at a local college in St. Paul. And about the time I finished school, the family and I reached the mutual conclusion that I did not belong at home anymore. I think I was out on a 4-day alcoholic research project and came home and found my suitcase on the front porch, is about how that went. And armed with my degree and my newfound freedom, I struck out to make my mark in the world, and I took a position as a carry-out boy in a liquor store. Or a delivery boy. I lost that job for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck, and one occasion I almost killed a little girl backing out of a driveway, stone drunk, about 11 o'clock in the morning, making a delivery. I took a job as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis, living on Skid Row, drinking a quart and a half of booze a day. I weighed 210 pounds, my life was an absolute mess, and I lost contact with everybody that I grew up with. That part of my alcoholism was not typical of my alcoholism. I share it with you mostly because it was the trough of my alcoholism. My days consisted then of getting up in the morning about 10 o'clock and taking a Dexedrine and drinking a six-pack of beer. I'd go into work about 11:30, and I'd work from then till about 2. And at 2, I'd go to a bar and drink as much beer as I could get in me from about 2 to about 5:30. And then I'd go buy a quart of Southern Comfort, and I'd put it in my locker, and I'd pour it into a half-pint bottle, and I'd finish that, and then I'd have to go find a place to stay for the evening. Usually that was making contact with a woman of some sort and finding a place to go. And toward the tail end of that process, I was a little short on funds, as I usually was, and we had a guy that I worked with who was a heroin addict, and his wife was a prostitute, and I used to live in the room she worked out of. And whenever she had a customer, I used to go walk around the block, you know, until she was done, and then I could go back in and, you know, we'd share the cost on the room, and it worked out to be a pretty good deal most times. And things weren't going well. It wasn't progressing. One of the faculties that almost killed me as a drinking alcoholic, that's been no end of joy to me as a recovered alcoholic, because I've never been able to watch anybody live. You put me in a group of people, and I'm going to become part of that group of people, and that saved my life when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it damn near killed me when I was out there in the brick. Someone better get that, or I'm... I lost that job because I got beat up so badly I couldn't go back to work, looking the way my face looked. And I did what I always did when I really ended up in trouble. I went back to my family, and I said, hey, can I come home? And they said, yes, you can come home if you follow certain rules. There's 8 other people in the house, and we love you, but, you know, you're just the eye of the tornado, baby, and we just is too tough. Like a good little drunk, I promised to follow the rules, and they let me back in the house, and, of course, the rules implied no drinking. In those days, I did most of my drinking from midnight till about 3 o'clock in the morning after I got home when everybody else went to bed. Alcoholism meant lots of different things to me, but maybe what it meant more than anything else is about every 6 months I had to start my life over. I was one of those people that just kind of existed between crises. I would coast along, you know, holding it together until some significantly bad enough event happened to me that I'd have to stop everything. And then I'd go around and I'd tell stories and write checks and calm people down and get out of trouble and get it all back. And then I'd start over again. And each time I started over, it was really going to be different. I was a young guy who, without question, was out of step, and I didn't really want to be out of step. I think mostly what I wanted was very much what my family wanted for me. I just didn't know how to get there. But at this high point in time, I made maybe the largest full-court press of trying to put my act together that I had ever tried. It occurred to me that if I could put certain things into my life, it would make my life okay. That if I could find a woman that I loved and that she loved me and we got married, that would make a big difference in my life. That if I could get a job that was a career sort of thing rather than this part-time fooling around wondering what I'm going to do about the service, that would make a big difference. And that if I could get away from the family, which is interesting because I was just moving back in the house, that would make a difference. I didn't like crying myself to sleep listening to my parents argue about what to do with the schmuck. I mean, that just was not... I love my family. You would not have known it if you watched my behavior, but those of us who have heard a lot of people who are important to us know that that's just part of the game, I guess. And so I started to put the things into my life that I thought would make my life okay. I got back together with the girl that I'd gone with for a couple of years and broken up with for quite some time. We became engaged to be married. And today she is my very lovely wife, Linda, who's a very active member of Al-Anon. It's a very important part of our family recovery and the mother of our three children. And I got a job as an executive trainee with a manufacturing concern in Minneapolis, and I bought my first automobile. And I thought, hey, it's really going to happen. I'm finally going to become what I always wanted to be when I grew up. Only it didn't happen to me because I continued to drink and have difficulty. And I was they like you to work on Mondays and stay on Fridays and some of the things that sometimes are pretty difficult. We had a photographer at that company that I was in such bad shape. I used to go to the bathroom in the morning and I'd fall asleep in the john. And it was just terrible. You know, you'd be in such... And then they'd page you and you'd go out there and both your legs would be asleep. I don't know if you... You know, and I almost couldn't stand up, you know, wandering down the hall. And my career is... And we had a photographer that used to hide me in a dark room. He used to put a board up over the developing tanks and I'd go in there and crawl in there and sleep my hangovers off until someone would be looking for me. And with that keen sense of alcoholic timing, I left that position, took a job selling business equipment, and I had that job about 4 or 5 weeks, I guess, and I went out on about a 4-day drunk. And the first 2 days I called in, and the next two I didn't. And I woke up in a friend's apartment one afternoon, and I didn't know if I had a job. I didn't know if I had a fiancé. I didn't know if my family would allow me to continue to live at home until I was married, and that was an economic necessity because I was a financial disaster. And I was just feeling bad, and I was scared. I guess is the phrase I had been in a long time. And all of a sudden, the recommendations of my father and my psychiatrist about Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem so dumb. And I picked up the telephone, and I asked the operator for the number of AA, and she gave it to me, and I called it, and I got the automobile club, which is kind of how everything went in those days. And that lady must have had that call before, because honest to God, she gave me the number of AA, and I called it, and I got the central office in St. Paul. I got a guy by the name of Stu, fine old gentleman. And I said, my name is Bob, and I think I have a drinking problem. I'd like to talk to someone. And he said, hold on this line. I could call someone on the other line. So he called someone on the other line. He said, can you go to the St. Clair Broiler in about an hour? Do you know where it is? I said, yes. And he said, describe two fellas, and he said that they'd meet me there. And I hung up the telephone. And as soon as I hung up the telephone, I was kind of sorry I called. You know, the blood had started to move around. I thought possibly I might live. I called in work and found out I still had a job, and I called Linda and found out she was still talking to me, you know, and I said, you know, you always feel guilty when you get up. You overreact, you know, you are pretty young. And the only reason I went to go meet those two fellows is I wanted to see what an alcoholic looked like. All minority groups look alike. I thought possibly if I could see what an alcoholic looked like, I'd come away with a better idea as to why I was not one. So I got in my car and I drove over to meet these two fellas. And if you wanted to sit me down and talk to me about my alcoholism, you had two choices. You also had to be willing to discuss the rottenest thing that I knew about you. Or you had to be willing to wade through as much anger as I could put out. And the idea was, you can come and get me, baby, but it ain't going to be for free. And as a result, not too many people had heart-to-heart chats with me about my alcoholism. But these two fellas threw a curve at me. They never gave me a chance to tell them that they had the wrong information, that they didn't understand, that, you know, they were mistaken. Because they knew how to make a 12-step call and knew what the message was. They didn't talk to me about me. They talked to me about themselves. They told me a little bit about what their drinking was like, what their experience was, how they got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what it was like today. And they did it well enough. And what I mean by well is that they were sincere and honest and straightforward and spoke from their experience, that all of a sudden I found myself identifying with them. And they asked me if I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next night. And I said, yes, I would like to, and I did. And over the process of the next couple of months, I was privileged to make two discoveries which have saved my life. I drank twice after walking in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. Once, on a business trip to the West Coast after I'd been sober about 3 or 4 weeks, they told me to check into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as I got there, and of course I didn't, and I drank after 5 or 6 days of staying sober. I drank for the second part of the trip and didn't have enough money to fly home and a whole bunch of things. And I drank on my honeymoon after about 2 or 3 months of sobriety. And my wife and I honeymooned in Acapulco. And you know where the divers dive off those cliffs in Acapulco? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk from a height of about 90 feet. I was in the audience watching a world high diving contest. And after about 9 planters punches, that didn't look so tough. And God does watch after fools and drunks, because I was able to survive that. But after those two experiences, over a period of about 3 or 4 months, I was able to maintain my sobriety through those two discoveries. But before I share those two discoveries with you, I want to share with you the attitude with which I entered Alcoholics Anonymous. I share with you for two reasons. It's an important part of my story, but it's also been my experience that it's an attitude that revisits me when my thinking is not proper. And so it is a current piece of mental problem that I sometimes cope with in my sobriety. I used to get asked a lot of silly questions that a lot of us get asked. At least they seem kind of silly. Some went like this. They said, Bob, why do you drink the way you drink? I never had a very good verbal answer for that, because I was almost always in trouble. It was almost always the next morning, and I wasn't very glib, and I didn't know. But what went on in my mind was something like this. I said, I drink because I have problems. I don't have problems because I drink. I mean, if you knew how many times I started out to have it all work out okay, and somehow it just turned to, you know, just disintegrated before my very eyes, where I was just a victim of circumstance. And you wouldn't ask me why I drink the way I drink. If you knew all the difficulties I'd had, you'd understand perfectly well that I don't drink inappropriately for a person who has my problems. And sooner or later, the problems are going to go away, and I'm not going to have a drinking problem, so why don't we just change the subject of conversation? If I heard this next statement once, I heard it 400 times in my drinking career. And I said, you know, Bob's a hell of a guy if he just wouldn't drink. You know, and usually if you're a young alcoholic, they usually attach the word potential to that. You know, you've got so much potential. I thought they were going to put that word in my tombstone, you know. That. Well, you know, they gave me the very clear impression that what was wrong with me was swallowing bourbon. And if I ever stopped swallowing bourbon, I'd be okay. I got so I was afraid to stop swallowing bourbon. There was so much pressure on me. I mean, if I ever stopped drinking, I'd really have to be something. I thought it was pretty good letting them assume that I'd be something and I could stay drinking, you know. But very clear impression, stop drinking, your life would be okay. Well, like a lot of alcoholics, I had a couple of opportunities not to drink. And just before I went back to my senior year at Notre Dame, I was out on a research project and I ran into a bad batch of ice. And the evening went bad. And I was beaten up, robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, shot at, and thrown out of the second story of an apartment building or a hotel, and I ended up in the state of shock in an alley. And long story, but they got me to the hospital, and I was waiting for my doctor to come patch me up. My regular doctor didn't come, my psychiatrist came. And then, you know, you're in some difficulty. And they weren't going to let me go back to school. And I always jokingly say, if you enjoy my talk here tonight, you should have heard the one I gave 14 years ago or 15 years ago to get out of the psych ward at Miller Hospital. I mean, it was the finest brief talk I've ever given. And they let me go back to school on the condition that I wouldn't drink, and I went back and I didn't drink for, I think, 3 or 4 months. And my life didn't instantaneously get better. I didn't all of a sudden become what I thought everybody was telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. I didn't become an A student. I didn't become a perfect Christian. I wasn't a model son. You know, and I thought I proved two things to myself. I was a daily drinker, and I thought I proved that obviously I could quit drinking anytime I wanted to because I just quit for 4 months. And number two, I proved to me beyond a shadow of a doubt that what was wrong with me was not swallowing bourbon. Because I just quit for 4 months, and baby, it wasn't there. That was not an answer. There was something wrong with me that was different. There was some cancer deep inside of me, some built-in failure mechanism, and, you know, drinking was not my problem. It was my answer. I used to get in trouble doing it once in a while, but by and large, I knew how to get it and where to get it and what it would do for me, and I put it down there, and I was pretty well satisfied with that experience, even though it caused me some difficulty, and wasn't a part of me. I had a great deal of difficulty, like a lot of us do, connecting all the chaos in my life with the physical act of swallowing bourbon. I was lodged between a sister who did graduate work at the University of Sorbonne in Paris, and a brother who was number two in law school, Phi Beta Kappa in law school. When you're lodged between two show-offs like that, you don't look very good. And I used to get asked questions like, Bob, wouldn't you like to be like, you know, someone else? And I say, yes. Where are the directions? You know, how do you do it? You know, as bad as it is, it's all I have. I don't have any other way to do it. And if that scares you, you ought to see what it does to me. They come to me and they say, Bob, I think you're an alcoholic. And I'd say, well, I can see with the information you have why you think I'm an alcoholic. But there's pieces of information about me that you don't have. Problems I've had before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol, hang-ups that I've had. Behavioral problems that I had, cold stone sober. Thinking problems that I've had, cold stone sober. Events that have happened to me that have nothing to do with drinking. And I think if you knew all about me, all the dark crevices of my life, you wouldn't think I was just an alcoholic, so thanks a lot for your concern, but why don't you get off my back? That was the attitude with which I presented myself at the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 23 years old. I was scared stiff. I didn't know whether to call you by your first name or your last name. Maybe because I was a student, I thought you were going to give me a test. I thought you were going to ask me why I was there. For some reason, I was worried that you were going to ask me what an alcoholic was. I don't know why I thought you were going to ask me that. But of course, you know what I found. I found a group of people who gave me a reception that was warmer than I ever anticipated as being. I found a group of people who came closer to understanding the way I thought than anybody I had ever run into in my life. You assumed things about me that I had never told anybody. I heard you freely sharing experiences in your own life that I had that I would never, couldn't even get out of my mouth. You know, those were the things that made me a moral leper and separated me from society, and I heard you laughing about them. And I was embarrassed a little bit, and I was intimidated a little bit by that, but I was intrigued by it, and you were my people. And I was privileged to make two discoveries which were to change my life. And number one, I made the discovery that alcoholism was a disease. And you say, well, everybody knows that. Well, I don't think I did know that. I thought alcoholism was something that happened to you when you were a whole lot older and a lot sloppier. And you had a problem living your life because you were just physically intoxicated all the time, and that didn't seem to describe me. Described me fairly well, but didn't seem to describe me. And I was told that alcoholism was a disease that affected me as a total person, mentally, physically, and spiritually. And I was told that once I crossed the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, that my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I was drinking and when I was not drinking. And that was very important for me to know, that there was a mental or emotional or psychological side to alcoholism, because as I told you, some of the problems I had, I just couldn't connect all of it with swallowing bourbon. I remember one old-timer told me, he said, Bob, you don't have a drinking problem. And I said, could you put that in writing? You know, we could solve this whole thing right away. And he said, no, smart aleck. He said, of course you got a drinking problem. But he said, if all you have is a drinking problem, all you have to do is quit. He said, have you ever quit? And I said, yes. He said, did it work? I said, no. He said, I didn't think it did. Because he said, what's wrong with you is alcoholism. And in my opinion, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is once we take our last drink of alcohol, we use the 12 recovery steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find a different way to live. A different way to live that's sufficiently better than the way we lived before, so that we don't have to go back to alcohol or pills to do something for us that we were unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. And if you don't find another way to live, you're going to go back to drinking because you don't know how to live without drinking. I don't believe I was ever told a truer thing in my experience in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing I learned is that there was a group of people in that room who had drunk an awful lot of alcohol, and now they weren't doing it. And the only observable reason for them not drinking is that they liked what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. And that intrigued me, because it had occurred to me that I might have to quit drinking, but I actually, at 23 years old, thought my life was over. I had so much of my identity tied up in being, I guess I would have said in those days, cool, but it wasn't cool. But I had so much of my identity tied up, so much of my friends, so much of my social life. So, you know, all I saw was a hole. But over a period of time in those meetings, I heard you share your experience, and I knew that you were people who took a pretty good swing at the fence, that you were out there doing it, a lot of you, a lot harder and a lot longer than I had, and some of you not as hard as I had, but you were out there, and now you weren't doing it, and I could tell by listening to you that you were genuinely getting something out of life, and I was intrigued by that, and that interested me a lot. As a result of those two experiences, I've been allowed to initiate my recovery and stay with you these years, and I think fundamentally the reason I've been able to maintain my sobriety is that I was able to find in sobriety what I tried to find in a bottle. I'm very glad that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was a whole answer for me. It wasn't just that answer about just don't drink and everything's going to be okay, because that seemed to be only part of my problem, because I do believe, like our book says, that drinking was a symptom of my illness. Recovery has been quite an adventure. I think recovery has been every bit as much of an exciting journey for me as my alcoholism was. There hasn't been quite as much terror in it, but it's been an interesting, unpredictable process for me. I came to you, I think unknowingly, with a lot of difficulties. One of my difficulties was, I guess that I was 23 years old and I didn't know a lot about life. Some of my immaturity was due to my alcoholism, and some of my immaturity was due to chronology. I just wasn't very old. And I had a lot of attitudes about life that weren't very correct. My sponsor used to say to me, he said, Bob, he said, you know a lot more than you understand. And I think that's a compliment. I've assumed all these years that that's a compliment. Another thing he told me, he says, you know as much about reality as a dog does about his father. And I have not computed that. He's full of all sorts of witty little sayings that I... But I came to you, I think, with the expectation that what recovery would be was the absence of problems. I was a young guy who was brought up in a parochial religious education, and I think I got the very clear message that there were people who lived that did not sin and did not have problems. And I didn't think anybody over 40 years of age had a problem. I honestly, all I wanted to do was survive to be 40 years of age. There were guys in our group who were 40 years old and they owned automobiles. They had had jobs that they had been on for 12 and 13 years. They knew what they were going to be when they were grown up. Well, hell, they were grown up. I mean, they were just, my life seemed to be just one gigantic question mark, you know, and I was so self-involved that I know I sat at meetings and I heard those people honestly share the difficulties that were in their life, and for a hell of a long time I couldn't hear them, because anybody who had economic or circumstantial circumstances that were better than mine, I don't think I could hear your problems. Because I was so self-involved. And so I assumed that you didn't have any, and that if I got my cart down the road, I wouldn't have any either. But of course, that was not my experience. I continued to have a lot of difficulties sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. The biggest event early on in my recovery was the removal of my wall. The first thing drinking robbed me of was a little bit extra that it took to be a success at anything that I did. It kind of took the hop off my fastball. And then pretty soon, I wasn't even doing enough to get by. And when I wasn't doing enough to get by, I just instinctively started to lie and cover up and build a wall and a shield between you and me so that you couldn't see what was going on in my life. And the thinking that went on behind this wall was something like this. It said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. Because if you could see everything about me, you'd hate my guts. because I hate my guts. And who knows more what a lousy, insufficient, crummy person I am than me? You see, I was walking around comparing my insides with your outsides. And the only way to come out doing that, I guess, is second best. But at some point in time in my recovery, behind that wall, I became afraid enough and I hurt enough. And there was just so much pain that I started to tear my wall down. And I said, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but God, just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. And that process started when I called Alcoholics Anonymous. It continued in my relationship with my sponsor, and it culminated in my fifth step. And for the first time in my life, I tore my wall down and I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. You see, up till that time, I had never shared the whole deck of cards with someone. No one ever had. I used to kill you with the piece you didn't have. My wife had part of the information. You know, my employer had part of the information. My family had part of the information. My friends had part of the information. But no one had all of the information. And you'd try to help me, and I'd say, yeah, I don't know what the information you have, why you think that way. But there's, you know, there's stuff you don't know about me, and if you knew about that stuff about me, you'd think something else was going on. So I was able to neutralize you with the pieces of me that you didn't have, and I was almost terminally unique. But I got to a point where I couldn't afford my uniqueness. And I made a discovery when I took my wall down and I shared the whole deck of cards. The discovery was that I wasn't unique. That my personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my experience, not my feelings, not my problem. And that was so important for me. I shared all those things with you, and you looked at me and you said, Bob, we understand. And I knew that you did. And for the first time in my life, I both felt understood. And I also started to have some small hope that a solution that was not unique could then apply to my life. See, I'd been exposed, like a lot of us have, to some pretty good answers. My family had pretty good values. The schools and the places that I've been exposed to had pretty good principles, and people who were able to employ them in their lives did pretty damn well, but I wasn't able to employ them. And I was always a good starter. I mean, in those processes, I was just a hell of a starter, you know, but I never finished. And I had a great fear that when I came to you, I was once again going to be a hell of a starter, but I wouldn't be able to finish it. Because even though I heard you share those things, I say, yeah, but I'm different. You know, I could have done better. You know, for me, it's different. Even when I heard you share something about yourself, because I was so used to thinking so self-involved. But once I made the discovery out of necessity that I wasn't unique, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I was part of you. And I felt that a solution that operated in your lives and gave you some relief and progressed your recovery could work in mine. Made another discovery in that process. I've been surrounded by love all my life, but I never felt particularly loved. Because I guess I thought they loved me, but they didn't understand me, and if they understood me, they wouldn't love me. But I came to you, and I was forced through my own pain to share my life with you. And I shared it with you, and you told me that you understood, and I knew that you did. And then you told me and you showed me that you loved me. And for the first time in an awful long time, I felt loved. And that's been a gift that I received in the program with Alcoholics Anonymous. And since that time, I've been able to receive love even from people who don't understand me. And I think, once again, that's something that you taught me how to do. But, you know, a funny thing happens to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're pretty resilient people, and we get well pretty quick. All of a sudden, I found myself 3 months and 6 months and 9 months sober, having problems that I didn't think someone 3 months and 6 months and 9 months sober should have, so I didn't tell anybody. I didn't want them. You know, I was the youngest guy in our group for almost 2 years, and I was treated unbelievably well by some senior members of Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes roughly, but with the kind of senior care that, you know, only the senior members of Alcoholics Anonymous can show. And I didn't want to disappoint them, so I didn't think they really wanted to know that my checking account was $700 overdrawn, you know, and we'd go out for coffee and I'd pick the bill up, you know, because I that's just the way I was, you know. So I started to adapt the attitude, thank you very much for helping with my drinking problem, but stay out of my finances, and I put a brick up. Thank you very much for helping with my drinking problem, but stay out of my marriage, and I put another brick up. Stay out of my sex life. Stay out of my job. Stay out of my social relationships. brick by brick, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, a year and a half to 2 years, I built my wall back up. I spent my first couple of years in Alcoholics Anonymous studying the program. I was kind of a lot. My sponsor said I was what he refers to as being stark raving sober. I was absolutely everywhere. I joined everything. I went to all the meetings. I sought out the older members of Alcoholics Anonymous and emulated them and repeated their words. I think I sounded better a year and a half sober in Alcoholics Anonymous than I may sound tonight. But my life was a catastrophe. And I was on a honeymoon in AA. I had about a year where I know the circumstances in my life were difficult, but I never even noticed it. I mean, I just, you know, coasted through that period of forgiveness that we're allowed, thank God. But the second year was not a honeymoon, by any means. And I found out at the end of the second year that the steps were not only something that you discussed, and not only something that you studied, and not only something that you talked about, and gave, you know, at meetings, but they're actually something that you did. And I found it necessary to start to try to employ those principles in my life and to try to live those steps. And the only way I got there was pain. And I started to do that and walk through the steps and my life started to get better. But once again, I was to have some difficulty because, as I told you, what I thought recovery was to be was the absence of problems. Something else happened to me that you didn't tell me was going to happen to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to you with kind of this kind of thinking. Okay, I've got the problem, right? And you've got the answer. And if I've got the problem and you've got the answer, there are four or five other things that are going on in my life that are just killing me. And if I've got the problem and you've got the answer, you ought to be able to make those things go away. And I'll be reasonable. It might take a year. And those who are laughing are, of course, are here longer than a year and know that at the end of my year, my problems didn't go away. But that such was what I thought was to happen. And they didn't go away at the end of 2 years, or 3 years, or 4 years. But the other thing that was happening that you didn't tell me about was, you see, my problems didn't change so much in sobriety, but I didn't notice them the first year sober. But you changed me. You changed my self-honesty. You raised my values. You gave me some principles to live by, and you set an example for me. And all of a sudden, problems that I had 1 year sober, that didn't bother me at all 1 year sober, I didn't even notice it 1 year sober, was eating my lunch 4 and 5 years sober. The problems I had in my life were manifold. I had chronic work problems. I couldn't get up in the morning. I'd set the alarm clock for 7 and get up at 8:45 and crawl into work at 9:15, and then I'd go for one of those 2-hour AA lunches and leave work at 2:00. And my career wasn't progressing real well. I had money problems. I was spending about $200 a month more than I made, and if you do that over a long period of time, you end up in debt. There's some relationship, I think, between the amount of money you spend and the amount of debt that you have. I'm not sure. I'm still working on that. I was by that time the father of 2 boys, and I was scared to death of being a father. I had a wonderful father, but even wonderful fathers make a few mistakes, and I was never going to make the few mistakes my father made, and I not only made the few mistakes my father made, I made just a whole hell of a lot of them that my father didn't make, and I had a fast hand and a loud mouth, and I was scared to death about being a parent, didn't think I did it very well. I was very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was afraid that something would go on that I wasn't part of. And my way of dealing with that was to be part of everything. And my wife started asking me if one of the things I wasn't to be part of was our marriage and our family. And I thought she ought to, you know, knock that off and start talking about her Al-Anon program and isn't she grateful, and anytime, anywhere, the hand of AA reaches out, I'm supposed to be there. And I got into playing a lot of backgammon down at the athletic club in the afternoons, and there was just a lot of those sorts of things going on. They don't sound like much, but one day, you know, over a period of time, that just started to drive me into a depression that just wouldn't quit. See, by this time, I had done a lot of sponsoring of people, and I had been exposed to you, and I knew the power of the program. And I knew it was unnecessary that I continued to have problems at the depth that I was having them. But day in and day out, I would promise myself that these things wouldn't happen to me. And it wasn't occasionally that these things happened to me. It happened all the time, over a long period of time. And, you know, my life was just bad. I'd go to the AA club and a new guy'd walk in that door with that bushel basket full of cancer, you know, that they walk in with, and he'd dump it all over you, you know, telling you about his wife and his job and everything. And I'd take that guy and I'd get him a cup of coffee, and I'd say, hey, baby, as bad as it is, as hopeless as it seems, if you come in here and do the things that we try to do together, it's going to be okay. It really, honest to God, it's going to be okay. And then I'd get in the car and I'd drive home and I'd say, hey, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? You know, I mean, you're sober 5 or 6 years in the program. When's it going to be okay for you? When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to learn how to not be a big shot and live within your means? When is that going to happen? And I wasn't sure when it was going to happen, and I was concerned about that. You know, we have the ability to receive the new member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a type of non-judgmental love and understanding that I think is absolutely unparalleled in any fellowship or organization in the world. A new guy could walk on that door tonight and tell us he's having a love affair with a zebra, and two people get him a cup of coffee and tell him they too are having a love affair with a zebra. But you know, I don't know if it's any different in Raleigh, North Carolina, but let a person 8 years sober walk in that door and tell that to you, he might get shot. My need for non-judgmental love and understanding is no different today than it was when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous today for a living problem that I had, not for a drinking problem that I had 13 years ago. I have to deal with what's going on in my life today. I have to be current. If I'm not dealing with the mental and spiritual aspects of my disease with the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not treating my illness. It's been my sad experience to watch people who go long enough with not treating their alcoholism and they end up taking a drink sometime. And as many of us know, we all get another drink, but we're not guaranteed necessarily another recovery. And I felt very much alone. I felt very much isolated, and that isolation was much of my own making. But I think I also put forward to us that I think all of us might consider that those of us who are sitting around meetings that are 7 and 8 and 9 and 2 and 3 and 4 years sober can have significant problems in their life. And I don't want to give you the impression that my sobriety was a horrible event. It wasn't a horrible event. My sobriety, contrary to what the impression, of course, when you condense it in the talk, it's difficult to give the whole flavor. My sobriety was wonderful. But the only way I've ever been able to make significant changes in my life, unfortunately, is through pain. And I get over a period of time, and it just gets more uncomfortable for me. And finally, I get to the point where I'm more afraid not to do something than I am of doing something. And then I start to change. And by this time, I had an idea where I was to go. I had started to go around and shoot my mouth off behind these microphones a little bit. And I've been exposed to some senior members of Alcoholics Anonymous who I had great respect for. And I started both to talk to them and to find out and observe what was different in these people's lives. And without question, I came to the conclusion that these people had a close personal relationship with the God of their very own understanding. And I guess I knew that I was going to go there, but you see, I had stopped growing spiritually when I was about 13 years old. I had grown up in a religion that was very, very important to me, and I went all the way through that parochial education. It was a very important part of my value system. When I got to be about 15 years old, I couldn't play the game by the rules anymore, and I had to drop out. And I never was able to deal with that in my adult. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous with the spiritual development of an angry 13 or 14-year-old kid. My blood pressure used to go up about 50 points just driving by a church. You know, I was so angry. If anybody gets too spiritual in a meeting, I'd just turn inside out and almost walk out of the meeting. I had a level of resentment. I didn't know how to deal with it. And my idea was, I understand that I've got to go to God. I knew who God was and what his rules were and what his name was and where he lived. I just didn't know what he had to do with Wednesday. You know, I just literally couldn't, you know, get into that. I just couldn't deal with it. So at this point in time in my life, I did the only thing I knew how to do in the program of AA. I went back to the steps. And I went back to the steps, and I found out what step one meant to me 7 years sober. Not what step one meant to me intellectually, not what step one meant to me when I was drinking alcohol. What step one meant to me when I was 7 years sober. I found out about my unmanageability and my powerlessness, and I found out about my alcoholism. And I took step two, and I went over to my sponsor, and on my knees in my sponsor's office, I took step three. I guess I never noticed very much specifically how our book recommended to take step three. And by this time, I had started to do some outside reading, which our book recommends and allows. And I started on the process, but I was stuck. And I was stuck because my idea was, is I know I have to have a relationship with the God of my very own understanding. But what the hell is the use of having a relationship with the God of your very own understanding if you can't change? I mean, how do you, you know, as soon as I get rid of my problems, I'm going to have that relationship. But there's no sense having the relationship living the way I'm living, because I continue to set the alarm clock for 7 o'clock and get up at 9:30. And that, you know what kind of a person does that? A crummy person does that. That's an unsuccessful person does that. A dishonest person does that. And I was dealing with just this wide sense of insufficiency and failure, and I didn't know how to get out. I remember one time one of my sponsors said to me, he said, you know, Bob, what your problem is? I said, no. He said, you can't get up in the morning. Never thought about it that way. I thought my problem was I was dishonest and unsuccessful. But one night I was sitting around doing something, and I guess I was kind of contemplating whether or not to call my sponsor or commit suicide. I guess were kind of what I was going through. And I thought, oh, what the hell, I'll call my sponsor. And I went through that deal where I was going to go out of town and talk to some guru, you know, some older member of Alcoholics Anonymous in some other city and that sort of thing. And I was trying to pick the city I was going to go to and all that. But I went over to my sponsor. And I'd taken a fourth step by this time, and I called him up and I said, I want to take a fifth step with you. And when I'm done with that, be careful, because whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do. And I said, the only thing I know for absolutely sure, it is both unnecessary that I am stuck where I am stuck. There's just too much power available in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to be where I am in the pain that I am a year from now, and I'm willing to go through, with your help, whatever I have to go through. We went over to the boardroom of his company, and I took a fifth step with him, and after I took my fifth step, we cried a little bit and had a cup of coffee and talked. And one of the things he wanted me to do was go to a clinical psychologist. And I can't tell you how much I didn't want to go to a clinical psychologist, but I did, and as a result of that, I was able to get in touch with some things I was able to bring back into my program. And one night I was home in my living room. I'd been doing some reading, and it had just been a horrible day. It had been a day that I had not done all the things I wanted to do and had done a great number of things that I hadn't wanted to do. And I realized that I had tried about as hard as I knew how to try to change. And I had failed over a long, extended period of time. And all of a sudden, it occurred to me that that was exactly where I was meant to be in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was allowed the privilege to take the sixth and the seventh steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sixth step says we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and the seventh step says we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. So I had spent 7 years in the program of AA trying to get rid of my defects of character. And I submit to you that you go about the process of trying to get rid of your defects of character differently than you go about the process of getting entirely ready to have God remove your defects of character. A friend of mine describes that. He said, it's a farmer doesn't grow. A farmer creates a fertile environment and plants a seed and creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place and God grows. And a doctor doesn't heal. A doctor creates an aseptic environment and creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place and God heals. And we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place and God changes us. And the atmosphere is the atmosphere of the attitudes of the sixth and the seventh step. And it's the three requirements of the program of being honest, being open-minded, and being willing. That night, out of fear, I forced myself to, as completely as I was able to, take the sixth step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Up till that time, I felt like I was a victim of my own defects of character. I felt like I was watching my life on TV. I'd get home after a bad day and I'd say, it happened again. I'd say, what do you mean it happened? Well, you know, I did all those things I wasn't going to. It was like it was happening to me. Like it was so habit-filled that it was something that happened to me. And I finally got to the point where I realized it wasn't happening to me, that I was choosing it. And as a result of choosing it, I couldn't get where the program and you people told me I could go. I just couldn't get there because I was hanging on to this. And it wasn't that I wanted to let go of this, because I had a long, sick relationship with a lot of those things, but I just got scared. And that night, I became willing because I was afraid to continue the way I was going. I thought my sobriety was in jeopardy, and I took the sixth step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and four of the problems that I had been dealing with day in and day out disappeared. Went away. Well, they happened in very ordinary ways. I hired a woman to call me every morning at 5:30 in the morning. Alcoholics always do things in moderation. I couldn't get up at, 8 o'clock. But I mean, I cooperated in a worldly manner with those things. God didn't come down in my living room and sit me down and, endow me. But my life changed from that point on. Never has been a question in my mind whether the program had the power to deal with all the things that I was dealing with in my life from that point on. I don't own that territory. I rent it from time to time. I still get lost in the weeds a little bit because I get involved with self. I guess I've come to the full realization that for me, step three isn't so much a step that I take. I think it's a fact of recognition of something that always is. I think my life always has been, is right now, and will always be in the care of God as I understand it. I think, to a great extent, I'm an ant on a log going down a river. It gives me the impression when it goes around the bend that I'm steering the log. But I think, to a very large degree, that is my relative importance to things. I think most of life is unfolding just about as it should. I can position myself on the log to get less wet from time to time. And that's mostly what I try to do when I stay in touch with that. Every once in a while, I forget that and I get back into running my own life and being the director and trying to get you what I need to have you do to be okay with me. And, of course, I usually get disappointed and anxious, and it doesn't work out very well. Today, I am happily married and in love with my wife. We have three sons, an 11-year-old boy, a 9-year-old boy, and a 5-month-old boy, so I won't give any lectures on family planning. I'm self-employed, and I'm making a living. And I'm self-supporting through my own contributions, and I'm a good worker today. I found a freedom in that that I never thought I'd ever find. I enjoy, it isn't even working today. It's just something I do, and that really works out pretty good. I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm active in my group. I'm active in sponsorship. I'm active with my own sponsor, and I'm active in service. And I continue, this is my home. This is my place, you are my people, and I hope that I always have the opportunity to live with you and to spend my life and to try to put back in just a modicum of what you've given me. Because there wasn't a roadmap to get from that 23-year-old kid that walked to the front door and said, hey, can I come in, to where I am today. And I'm so glad that someone didn't ask me to write down on a piece of paper when I was a year sober what I wanted out of this program, because had I written it down, I wouldn't have gotten what I got. If I would have gotten everything I put on the piece of paper, because a lot of the things I didn't want in those days, I've received, and some of the things I thought I would have needed, I haven't received and I didn't need. And it's been a marvelous experience for me, absolutely marvelous. We've been given a treasure and a gift in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. No one else can do what we do. There's all sorts of places to go to get treated for the illness of alcoholism, and they do a very good job of it. But there's only one place to go with ready access, and I'm aware of for a majority of the people, to recover from the illness of alcoholism, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Our founders are dead. Our founders, with some guidance, gave us a program. one of the gentlemen tonight, read how it works. In 1950, they handed the program back to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, it's yours. We're going to join Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to try to become members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You come of age, and the program is yours. The responsibility for the program is yours. The guardianship of those principles is yours. And if you don't do it, it isn't going to be done because no one else can do what we do. No one else can look another alcoholic in the eye and say, hey, I've lived it, I've been there, I've had the problem. Come with me and do what I do, when I do it and how I do it, and get better with us. Join us and walk that road, and it's going to be okay. No one else can do that. If we took everybody in this room and put them in a spaceship and took a journey to the nearest star, the nearest star is a star called Alpha Centauri. Approximately, it's about 7 million light years away. And if we went 100,000 miles an hour, it would take us about 300 years to get there and about 300 years to get back. When we got in that spaceship, everybody in this room would know who they were, where they had come from, where they were going, and why. But it isn't very hard to understand that if they didn't very carefully pass that information on, generation to generation, unchanged and intact, that you could end up with a spaceship just chock full of people 150 years out there on that trip who were literally lost in space. Now, when it all comes down to it, our primary purpose is to help the still suffering alcoholic. That's our charge. That's the gift that we have. If we ever lose that faculty, we might as well shut the door, because that's ultimately what it's all about, is one drunk looking at another drunk in the eye and caring about him and sharing not his ideas, but his experience. And I hope that we take the message that is in our book called Alcoholics Anonymous, unchained, unadulterated, pass it through our own experience and take it from the older member, the direct link to the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am very impressed with the older member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with their dedication. Those men and women who held meetings with two and three people in a room waiting for that next one to come along and had the doors open for me. Okay, I'm impressed with that. And sometimes those of us who are a lot younger and came in and didn't have to go through all the pain and suffering, we forget that sometimes we see so clearly because we're standing on the shoulders of men and women who didn't have it quite as easily as we had and were dedicated in a way that I'm not sure I would have had the dedication that they had. But I hope we take that message unchanged from the older member of Alcoholics Anonymous and pass it through our own experience in our lives and live it with integrity. Remember what Dr. Silkworth said in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous when he was recommending Bill Wilson to someone? He said, you may rely absolutely on anything these people tell you about themselves. How many of us in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous could get that recommendation? I think a lot of us could, but I hope that that might be a sight, that we would live our lives in a manner and hold our programs in such a way that someone could say that about us. So that 20 years from now, when someone comes wandering in a door like this, he doesn't find a room just chock full of people who don't know who they are, where they have come from, where they are going, or why. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I said I didn't remember him. In 1974, I just got where I could remember my name good. Bob is a token of our appreciation. I'd like to present you this little gift. Thank you again. If there's nothing else, we'll stand and close with the Lord's Prayer. Those who will. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.